from 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Greater Boston braces for another round of snow.
The number one thing that we have to remind people on with these first storms of the season, you really need to clear your car off before you leave the driveway. It's not good for the people behind you. We don't want to cause any unnecessary accidents.
Also today, caring for loved ones, a shared experience that too often goes unacknowledged.
My life is actually hell a lot of the time, and I had no idea. No idea. It makes me really have respect for people who have done this, paid or unpaid, for years that I just thought were just doing another job.
We'll take your calls on caregiving. And keep the calls coming for Congressman Seth Moulton. We'll talk impeachment hearings and the president's decision to pardon a convicted Navy SEAL. That is all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Another storm is making its way toward us with the potential to bring more snow to Greater Boston and eastern Massachusetts. We've all got questions. And here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein with some answers. He joins us now via Skype. Dave, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So, Dave, what should travelers expect for their commutes this afternoon? That is underway now.
Right. So the commute underway now in Boston and points just north and just south from Norwood all the way up to eastern Essex County. It's actually above freezing. So roadways are wet, but we're not seeing any snow or frozen precipitation for the present time. However, as you get west of 128, temperatures are below freezing. And so there's some slush on the roadways. Most of the roadways have been treated, so they're all passable. But just be aware, leave yourself a little bit of extra time. And again, some of that slush you're definitely going to contend with the further north and west you go from the city this afternoon.
How about overnight, Dave? Will there be shoveling?
Yeah, so overnight, what's going to happen is that, first of all, the 32-degree line is going to go all the way down to Cape Cod. So that means Boston, which is 38 right now, will go down to about 28 degrees by the time we get up tomorrow morning. And we will see these periods of snow developing, and they'll become a little bit steadier and heavier, especially inside of 495 and even heavier inside of Route 128. Now, this is not going to turn into a blockbuster snowstorm, but the timing of it for tomorrow morning's commute is such that that's when the heavier bands will be rotating through easternmost areas of Massachusetts.
So what does that mean? You know, people thinking about getting to work, school, other activities tomorrow morning. How should they be thinking about that?
Yeah, so I suspect that there's going to be some delays tomorrow morning only because we will have likely those heavier snow bands running from, say, Amesbury through Lawrence, Cambridge, Waltham, and rotating down through Taunton and even over Cape Cod. So at times a half an inch to perhaps an inch and a half of snow an hour for a few hours. That's going to mean 2 to 5 inches of snow that comes roughly from about 1 o'clock in the morning till roughly about 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. So in that little window, we're going to see that snowfall, which is right when people are going to be leaving for work.
Sounds like a lot of uncertainty, because that actually sounds like a fairly big window, 1 a.m. to 11 a.m. It seems like a lot could happen or not happen during that
time.
Well,
I mean, not really. You've got the snow falling in that window so that the 2 to 5 inches falls and the heaviest bands are right around the morning commute.
I think I'm just dying to know right now what happens when we can't do that. So, Dave,
yeah, I can't tell you what it's going to be doing at 6:02 in your neighborhood as much as folks would like that. That's not the way weather works.
It's not how it happens, is it? So what's causing it? Is this just our first nor'easter, or is this part of a larger storm system? What's behind this?
So the storm system, which brought a lot of snow to the upper Midwest late last week and then moved up into the Great Lakes, brought in a trailing warm front through us here last night. And that actually brought the snow, which was quite heavy, anywhere from, 5 to 15 inches of snow as you went south to north across the state. And what's happening is some energy is rotating down kind of underneath that storm. It's moving to the coastline. It will create a low pressure area just to our south. It's already there, but it's really going to make it a stronger storm. And as that moves out into the Atlantic, into Massachusetts Bay, and eventually the Gulf of Maine, it will throw the western edge of precipitation through the area here later tonight and into the first part of tomorrow.
When's it all done?
So I think that, if you're out listening to us from Worcester County or perhaps eastern sections of Connecticut or Rhode Island, I think we're done between 10, even 9 to 11. When you get closer to Boston, it probably doesn't completely shut off until 10 to noon, something like that. There may be some lingering snow showers Ipswich, Gloucester, and down through Plymouth and even the outer part of the Cape in the early afternoon hours. But they would not be accumulating that much at that point. I think, again, those heavier bands are focused on the morning commute.
Dave Epstein, WBUR meteorologist, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
All right, so let's talk about the roads now. We have Jonathan Gulliver. He's the state highway administrator on the line. Administrator Gulliver, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me on.
So you heard we just spoke to Dave Epstein, the meteorologist. Bad weather coming. How are the roads right now?
So right now, roadways are in pretty good shape. The timing of this last phase of the storm was perfect for making sure the roadways are in good condition for this morning. Usually after a heavy snowfall, we need about 4 to 6 hours to get the roadways in good shape. And where this ended in most places by 1 a.m., really gave us the time we need to get this down to pretty much bare pavement on all the interstates and a few slushy areas, especially north of the city and out in the Berkshires. But for the most part, roadways were pretty good this morning. Our guys really did a great job for the first storm out of the gate.
So what are you doing? What's the department doing to make sure highways are going to stay, you know, clear and safe as this next round of snow comes in?
So this next round of storm, this really is going to present some tricky issues for us. The problem that we're currently working on is waiting to see what our most recent forecast does as far as are we going to have any dry period in between when the snow starts and this current rain ends. That'll allow us to get in there and do some pretreatment. When it's raining like it is right now, we really can't do a lot of pretreatment. And if that quickly changes over to snow, you're going to get icy conditions. So we're really hoping, we're going to be watching that forecast come in and really make sure that our updates give us what that time frame is so that we can change our treatment options up the right way. If it stays the way it is right now and kind of does do that quick changeover, we're probably going to be bringing in a lot of our heavy equipment around 2 a.m. this morning and really get them on the roadways ahead of time, start delivering the salt and plowing as quickly as they can to make sure that we try to stay ahead of the storm as long as possible. But you just heard the timing of it, and that heavy snowfall coming down right in the middle of the morning commute is going to be problematic. And for sure, we're expecting that tomorrow morning is going to be a really, really difficult commute for most people.
So what kind of tips do you have for people who will have to be out in a car during that?
So if you absolutely have to be somewhere tomorrow, for one, you should really consider what you have for public transportation options. That's going to be your best bet in most situations. If you do have to drive somewhere, really give yourself a lot of extra time. I'm expecting that if this forecast holds, that roads are going to be really messy early in the morning. So it's going to take you a lot of extra time to get to wherever it is that you're going. So that's the main thing, is really just plan ahead in this case. And if you do have to be on the roads, remember still this is the first real significant snowfall we've had in quite some time. It's going to take some time to get those driving legs back. So if you're going to be out there in the weather, make sure that you give yourself a lot of extra space between you and the other cars on the road.
Should we be concerned about black ice tomorrow?
I think it's a little too early to tell if black ice is going to be a problem. I'd say they'll be ready for just about anything tomorrow. When it's this kind of varied weather conditions, you're going to see those kind of varied pavement conditions to go along with it. So at the very least, I'm expecting that you're going to have snow and slush-covered highways, especially during the heart of that morning commute. And then as the day goes on, that's going to turn to more slush. So that can get a little bit tricky. Like this morning, even though we were down to bare pavement everywhere, those slush-covered shoulders did cause some problems for folks that were straying a little bit off of the marked lanes, and we did see a number of spin-outs, especially, again, on those straightaways where you have slushy shoulders and also around the on- and off-ramps as well.
Administrator Gulliver, a minute ago you referred to sort of the first significant snowfall in quite some time. We are headed back into winter. Any overall strategy that you want to talk about for people as we brace for this New England winter?
Well, again, I think patience is key, you know, and any time you have any of these storms, and I know we say it over and over again, but it's the truth, is that you really got to plan ahead in these kind of storms and give yourself a lot of extra time and try to avoid driving if you can at all. So look at public transportation options. If you have a work-at-home option instead of being out there with everybody else, certainly take advantage of those situations. The problem we run into, especially when you have storms at the peak of commuting times, is that when you have backed up traffic, our plows get stuck in that same traffic as everybody else. And if they're stuck and not moving anywhere, that means they're not treating the highway ahead of them. And we don't want to be in a situation where we start losing a road because a truck is stuck in traffic. So really, the less people on the road during these really major winter events, the better.
That is Jonathan Gulliver, the Highway Administrator for the Massachusetts Department of Transportation. Thanks for joining us today.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, a new podcast takes a look at the complicated world of caregiving. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. My mom passed away 5 years ago this week from complications due to frontotemporal dementia. That Thanksgiving and Christmas were profoundly affected by her move to hospice and her passing away. But that was after several years of our family being shaped by the caregiving experience that we shared, beginning with my father caring for her at home. And we were not alone. Families, friends, and loved ones are engaging in this kind of caregiving every day. Sociologist Mindy Fried has created a podcast called The Shape of Care that delves into the experiences and challenges of caregiving, and she joins us now in Studio 3. Mindy, welcome.
Hi, thanks so much, Tiziana.
Also with us in the studio is Lori Sheridan, a caregiver featured in an episode of the podcast that's called When Your Romantic Partner Has Parkinson's Disease. Lori, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Tiziana.
We want you with us. We'd like you to join the conversation. Are you a caregiver for a loved one, or do you work in the caregiving industry? What challenges do you face in that role? How has that changed your relationship with the loved one you care for or are caring for? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'd love you to join the conversation. So, Mindy, let's start. Why did you want to create a podcast around this issue?
Well, you know, Tiziana, it started when I first cared for my dad in the last year of his life. And the experience was very profound. It was really intense. I'm a writer, and so I ended up writing a lot about it while he was kind of in decline. And after he passed away, I decided to write a memoir called Caring for Red, which
Red. Was Red your father's name?
Well, Red was both a redhead, and then he had been a communist. So he had two reasons. So I ended up touring with the book pretty extensively all over the country. I went to cities on the West Coast, the East Coast, the South. And one thing that really touched me was all the stories that I heard from people who had their own caregiving experiences that they wanted to talk about. And what I realized was that people were really isolated, despite the fact that caregiving is such a universal phenomenon in this country. And so I created a podcast to create a platform for a caregiving conversation. Hopefully to help people feel less alone, but also to provide resources and all kinds of, you know, connections that people could make around these issues.
You know, as we were preparing for this segment, Mindy, one of the things that we talked about and thought about was, I don't know why, but it seems like we are more aware of the responsibilities and the challenges of caregiving around the holiday season. Mm. Can you address that? Is that just perception? Is it because it's a time of family, or are the circumstances different around the holiday season?
I mean, I do think that everybody has their own family story, you know, from fabulous to not so fabulous. And families tend to get together during the holidays. And sometimes it's a time when you see a family member you haven't seen for a while and you get to see how aging has affected them. You know, I think that people in seeing their parents in that context sometimes realize that that there's something going on, that the aging process is starting to impede how they're living their lives. So I don't know. I mean, I think holidays are definitely intense for a lot of folks. And so certainly issues of taking care of one's loved ones comes up right then as well.
Lori, your husband Ira is suffering from Parkinson's disease, currently in hospice. First, how are you and how is he?
I'm okay. I'm exhausted. It's been a 15-year journey. Hospice is very helpful, and I actually am no longer the round-the-clock, hands-on caregiver because I'm too old and not strong enough anymore, and his disease has progressed to a point where I can't do it. And that, in some ways, is a relief because we have aides in the home who really help a lot. So I'm doing okay, and I'm able to come and go a little bit, although the holidays are hard because I can't go to New York and visit my grandchildren. I can't leave him long enough to do that. He's you know, continuously getting worse, and that's to be expected. Fortunately, it's a disease that tends to progress slowly, and there's plateaus and then steep cliffs he falls off of and can be much more impaired very quickly.
Lori,
but his spirits are good, so that helps.
Why did you want to share your story through the podcast?
I've been a community and labor activist all my life, and I'm used to talking with people about things and being out there and kind of organizing people. And on the other hand, caregiving and particularly Parkinson's are very, very isolating. So to be really honest, it helps get me out of my own loneliness and isolation. But also, I'm sort of a compulsive organizer, so I know that other people might be interested but aren't talking as much as it's easier for me to talk about what's going on. And there's not a lot of information out there about what to do when you're a lonely caregiver. So I thought it's not only therapeutic for me to be out there talking about my story, but it's a very universal story, as Mindy said, and I'm sure other people can relate to it. And it'll help them talk and get what they need. And maybe in the end, we'll actually organize to get some policy changes that we need.
We really want to invite you into the conversation. What's on your mind? Do you have caregiving experience? And what's it like for you today during this season? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Steve from Cambridge, let us know what's on your mind.
Hello.
Hi, Steve.
Hey, I'm kind of new to this caregiving thing. We're up at Spaulding. I kind of don't know the direction where I'm supposed to go. I understand that you're a writer. You're also an instrument of expression. I'm an actor, but I kind of get parked up here because I'm a New York-based, LA-based actor, and now I'm here. So, I mean, like, every day, every hour, I don't know how to predict a thing. So I just wonder like how you coped with it.
Steve, what kind of caregiving are you offering now? What's happened?
My dad got a stroke from traumatic brain injury about a year ago.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, thanks.
I'm sorry about,
and thank you for sharing your experience.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I'm going to turn back to Mindy now. So Steve is saying, this is new to me. I also had to relocate. Where do I even start, and how do I start to find some balance and put one foot in front of the other? What do you think, Mindy?
Well, first of all, Steve, thank you for being courageous and calling in, because what you're dealing with is incredibly difficult. What I find in talking to people who are caring for spouses or loved ones is that sometimes you feel like you have to do it all on your own. And, some people are not as comfortable talking to other folks about it or asking for help. So I guess the first thing I would just say is that if you feel comfortable sharing your story with people who are within your family or your friendship circle, to share some of the burden and ask for some support. I guess the other piece is that there are places where you could get some caregiver support. You know, honestly, if you Google it, you'll find a caregiver support group almost anywhere. There's senior centers, there's programs on aging and so on. And so, you know, a place where you could be able to kind of think through some of the issues that you're going through. There's also there's an online resource called Well Spouse that you might want to check out. So, you know, I think at this point, and, you know, it sounds like it's tough, but you don't have to do it 100% alone.
Steve, does that help you at all?
Well, you know, I also had another part of this. My other parent is also crippled.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and it's not really a physical crippling. You can see it's more of an emotional, psychological cripple.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of dealing with, and I am seeing therapists, but, you know, like a father that was emotionally, physically abusive.
Mm.
And, you know, back at it, my mother who was emotionally abusive also. And then both of them are crippled. Like,
yeah.
And also a complexity is that they're verbally crippled. It was a willful, intentional action not to learn English.
So, Steve, I appreciate you raising that, and I'm gonna turn to both Lori and Mindy on this, and I'm going to expound on that a little bit. One, Steve did mention that he's seeking support and help for him, too, because he's carrying these responsibilities. And one can also hear, and maybe I'm projecting from the time that our family went through this, some of the frustration that you experience as the person changes, or maybe brings out more of the parts of you, of them that you've been challenged by in the past.
Yeah.
Lori, does any of that resonate for you?
It certainly does. I mean, I run out of patience. I become frustrated. I become angry with Ira. Sometimes I don't know who he is or whom I'm dealing with. He's like a different person. And what's helped me is really two things. I mean, one, I've learned to be more patient. I've learned a lot from other caregivers, both paid and unpaid family caregivers, some of the skills in dealing with that. But what's helped me the most is being in a weekly support group of care partners.
How did you find it?
I found it through the hospital where he's seen for his Parkinson's disease, and that has the advantage that everyone in the group is caring for someone with the same disease, but that's not really essential because I've also had friends at work who were dealing with similar but not the same thing, and we've formed our own little support group just talking, you know, around the edges and at coffee and lunch about how we got through life. And I've learned a lot from all kinds of support groups about tips for how to get through the day and how to keep myself relatively intact,
Mindy,
because if I fall apart.
Mindy, is there, Laurie, I didn't mean to cut you off. I apologize for that. Is there any way to be prepared? I mean, so many times an illness comes on quickly or unexpectedly. Were you prepared for your responsibilities, and how can one, without being macabre, prepare oneself?
Right.
Seems like most people at some stage in their lives are going to have these kinds of responsibilities one way or another.
Right. I mean, I guess just, you know, to pick up a little bit with Steve's point about having parents who were unkind or abusive or whatever, that you're not alone. I've talked to so many people who have been in this situation, and it is such a struggle. And so I would just, you know, agree with Laurie about finding some support, but, you know, in either friends or in caregiver support groups. But there's also a movie that I wanted to tell you about called The Savages. It's about siblings who had an abusive father, and, you know, they are so angry and resentful of who he has been historically. And I know that their story is something that resonates for a lot of people. It's something you might want to check out.
But is it a fictional film or a documentary?
It is a fictional film. It's with Laura Linney and Philip Seymour Hoffman. It's beautifully made and very touching. But I think, Tiziana, to your question, you know, how can one be prepared? I mean, I think I've found that a lot of people are not ready quite yet to bring in support, or to, you know, they see that somebody that they love needs help, and that's kind of rebuffed initially. Sometimes, you know, the person who's in the position of being the caregiver sees what's coming down the pike. And what I always say is that it's really important to do your research on your end and have as much information as you can have, so that when things get a little worse, perhaps it's a crisis or it's just a little red flag that there needs to be an intervention, that you're ready with bringing somebody in or having your loved one assessed, evaluated to see what kinds of support they need. So I think that upfront time, it's both helpful to the person who is going to be a caregiver, but it's also ultimately helpful down the line to the person who needs caring for.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Karen from Jamaica Plain, join us. What's on your mind?
Yes, hi. I'm just sharing a bit of my recent experience having my mother transition to a nursing home, and just finding that, you know, we are pretty rudimentary in how we care for people at the end of life. And I really applaud Mindy and people like her who are trying to help us, you know, give a good quality of life to our loved ones. And I'm just wondering if, you know, both your guests have any ideas about advocating for better end-of-life treatment in nursing homes. I mean, because with my mom, she's not terminally ill, so it's kind of a new home for her. And
Karen, are you comfortable being a little more specific? Like, what's one thing that you wish were different?
Well, for example, you know, she's gone from living in a 5-room house that she's been in for 50-plus years to sharing a room with an Alzheimer's patient, and she is actually just going to be moved to, you know, the long-term part of the facility, and she will have someone she can talk to. Also, you know, what I see is that, you know, she was pretty, even though she was using a walker, she was ambulatory, and, you know, we had people coming in and they would take her places. And now, you know, within the space of weeks, she's a fall risk and she can't get out of a chair without help. She can't go to the bathroom without help. And it's really, it's like, you know, she's not in that place yet.
Karen,
but you also can't live in an apartment.
I appreciate your call, and I am sorry for the experience that you and your mom are having. I do want to add one more caller's voice to this, and then I'll turn back to our panelists. Charles from Somerville, you're on the line. What's your experience?
Hello. Is my mother, my parents were in Oregon. I'm here in Somerville. My sister in Philadelphia. So it was, and my brother lives in Oregon. So there was a lot of pressure on my brother and my father to care for my mother, who had she had deteriorating health. We didn't know it was due to advanced celiac disease.
Mm-hmm.
So she wasn't getting the nutrients to her brain.
Mm-hmm.
And then she had colon cancer, and that's when they found out she had celiac disease. Mm-hmm. And soon after that, she had she had the dementia. And it was, I when I went to visit, you know, it was like she knew me and then she didn't.
Mm, yeah.
And it was very very stressful. And I did a lot of research myself. We didn't have any support group, you discussed, people discussed earlier, which is fantastic to get the support group.
Charles, I'm going to take it from there. And I thank you for your call. I think it's hard, and I think it's giving of people to call in and share these experiences and raise these questions. We have Charles, whose mother was declining really in a very challenging way from afar. We have Karen in Jamaica Plain, who's just not comfortable with the care that her mother is receiving right now. How do people begin to advocate for the care that they want and need for their loved ones, either up close or afar? Mindy and Lori, what advocacy experiences have you had?
I've done both. I mean, I've had to advocate personally for care for my husband, and it has required, and also for my mother and my mother-in-law when they were alive, and it requires a lot of sort of due diligence and being in the facility as much as possible, working with the staff, and you walk a fine line between being a pain in the butt and they're overwhelmed with how many patients they care for, so they can be dismissive, or you can just be sympathetic of what the load that they're carrying and try to work with them to provide the best possible care for your loved one. And it can be a fine line because they tend to have 9 or 10 patients they're taking care of at the same time. In terms of advocacy, I've worked for years trying to improve the reimbursement rates for nursing homes and for the workers and organize them, some of them into unions, because it's an underappreciated, underpaid, unbenefited profession by and large. And in the long run, that's what really needs to happen. In fact, personally, I think Medicare needs to pay for long-term care, and it doesn't unless you're just fresh out of a hospital for a brief period.
So, Lori, I want to turn to Mindy here. And Mindy, I'm actually going to bring in some sound from episode 2 of your podcast, where you had Ai-Jen Poo, who's the co-director of Caring Across Generations, talking about the fact that women of color make up the majority of the caregiving workforce and that about a third of the home care workforce is foreign-born. But she also noted that the annual median income for a home care worker is $13,000
right.
per year. And here she is arguing that that is not a suitable wage.
Great.
The fact that the people that we're counting on to take care of our loved ones can't take care of their own families on the wages that they earn, that is, to me, one of the most fundamental and profound moral crises in our country. But then there's also the fact that we end up losing some of our very best caregivers because we have not invested in these jobs for their worth.
Mindy, we don't have a ton of time left, but I really do want to get into this some because there are serious fiscal and financial issues in a deeply flawed system.
Absolutely.
Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Right. So, you know, right now, just share a few stunning statistics with you. First of all, 10,000 baby boomers turn 65 every day. 17% of adults are caring for somebody 50 or over, and that number jumps up to 30% if you include people who are caring for someone who's ill or has a disability. So that's a lot of people who are playing the caregiver role. The care workforce, as Ai-Jen so beautifully points out, is underpaid, devalued. The work of caregiving, which is so central to, you know, our society and is becoming even more so given the demographic shift in our society, is not something that is being talked about at the national level. So I think that we need to really put those issues on the agenda, the political and policy agenda. We need what Ai-Jen calls what we need, that we're in a crisis tunity. She says it's a crisis and an opportunity, that we need a care grid or an infrastructure, something like what we have for our transportation system, something in which there's, you know, a web of services that are coordinated so that people really have places where they can go to get decent care. And I absolutely agree with what Ai-Jen's saying and certainly Lori is saying about the care workforce, that, you know, the turnover of home care workers is 60%. And what does that
per
do?
Per year?
On an annual basis, yes, there's a 60% turnover. So what does that do to the quality of care? Well, you know, if you've got somebody who's leaving on a regular basis, that means that they're not getting enough training. They're not developing the same kind of relationship with the person they're caring for. Rick Serpin, who founded a worker-owned home care organization, talks about the texture of relationships being the most important thing in caregiving. He says that sometimes the work itself is kind of rote, but it is that intense relationship that is so critical. And if that relationship is cut off because people cannot survive in the kinds of jobs that they have where they're not being paid more than, you know, $7, $8, $9, $10 an hour, then that's going to affect the quality of care that they provide. So there's a direct link between the quality of care jobs and the quality of care that people can provide to folks who need it.
Lori, you have said that you're used to being an advocate and an organizer. So somebody who wants to see structural or policy change, what's one step they can take right now, or a phone call they can make, or a policy that you might recommend they advocate for?
Talk to your legislator, local and state and federal, about the cost of care, and tell them what I think even few of them really realize, that the cost of care impoverishes families. You can either be on Medicaid if you're very poor, or you have to spend all your assets to be on Medicaid to cover the cost of care, unless you're a veteran or unless you're very wealthy and can pay for the cost of care, and hardly anyone knows that. And I think if legislators really understood that, and it has to be us, it has to be we, the caregivers and the family members, because the people we're caring for are not in a position to really advocate for themselves. They're sick or they're disabled, and their lives are very, very hard. I think also just getting the word out about what caregiving is like. I mean, when you were asking earlier about what prepares you for it, I thought, in a way, nothing prepares you for what it's like to see someone get old and it disabled. Yeah, I'm sure you know too, because it's a shock. And I haven't thought this out completely, but I feel like I wish everyone had some experience with older people. In many societies, people do, and families are together and they see their elders get old. I really didn't, and many people in our society don't, so there needs to be programs in schools that help people not only know what it's like to get old or to take care of someone who's old, but to sort of prepare psychologically for the fact that it's going to happen to them too. I mean, the one good side is I'm seeing what it's like to get old because I'm getting older myself too, so I know things I certainly didn't even know before Ira had Parkinson's. Mm-hmm.
Mindy, you cover so much in season one of this podcast. You know, stories like Lori's, you cover the caregiving workforce, policy issues, homophobia, and elder care. Mm-hmm. There is a season two coming. What are you hoping to explore in the next season?
Well, I will just say that I'm committed to creating season two. I need to raise the funds to make that happen. So I'm now looking for sponsors and for donations from anybody who would like to support the continuance of this podcast. I think that we need to delve more into the care workforce. And so I'm in conversation with various people about how to do that. And I think we need to delve more into the problems that that we're confronting with policy, the fact that we have such a disjointed policy in this country. It's not that there aren't some really stellar innovative programs, you know, like the PACE program, or in this – actually in Massachusetts, we have ASAPS, which is Aging Services Access Points, you know, like Ethos and Jamaica Plain. That would be one example. But, you know, by and large, we need to really look at the financing of the care system, the long-term care system in this country. And I would like to look more into that through stories. You know, it's not going to be boring. I promise everybody that.
Well, I'm sure today's conversation hasn't been boring for people who really are having this experience and feeling like, you know, I've heard so much from other caregivers, the isolation that they feel.
Exactly.
They think they're the only one having the experience. They're not.
That's right.
Yeah. Mindy Fried, creator and host of the Shape of Care podcast, I really appreciate you being with us
today.
Thank
you. It's been a pleasure.
And Lori Sheridan, a caregiver featured on the podcast. Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tisiana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering. One state goal for recreational marijuana stores that first opened in Massachusetts just over a year ago was to eliminate the risks of pot sold on the black market. But as licensed stores struggle to meet the demand, illegal sales actually continue. Reporter Nancy Cohen has our story.
Another cannabis store is getting ready to open in Massachusetts.
Tincture boxes, gummy chews boxes, and some examples of how we package our flower as well.
That's Brandon Pollock, CEO of Theory Wellness, pointing out a display in his soon-to-be-open store in Chicopee. But getting enough weed is a challenge.
It's a very difficult market right now to purchase wholesale cannabis to then sell to customers.
His company already owns another recreational store and two medical dispensaries, along with a cultivation facility.
We've seen continued growth month after month. Every day we have, say, 50% returning customers and 50% new customers.
Pollock says when Massachusetts rolled out the recreational market a year ago, cultivation facilities like his were still set up to serve medical customers, a much smaller market. So now they supplement what they grow by buying wholesale when it's available. By law, they can only buy from licensed growers in Massachusetts.
You can get into bidding war situations or just sort of these first-come, first-serve situations where it's difficult to find what you're looking for at times.
But the supply problem isn't stopping new stores from opening. The marijuana company INSA just opened a new one in Salem.
So we have the Incredibles Peanut Butter Buddha Bar.
At INSA's East Hampton store, a customer is buying an edible, pre-rolled joints, and more.
Okay, so your total is going to be $186?
INSA CFO Peter Gallagher says most of the time he limits sales to only a quarter of an ounce of flower at a time, even though the state allows sales of up to 1 ounce. Gallagher says other retailers are doing the same.
That's indicative of a market that is undersupplied.
He says part of the challenge is growing pot legally doesn't happen overnight.
It takes time. You know, if you think about how long it took us to go from proof of concept to licensed and cultivating, and then from cultivating to harvesting, and with finished supply available, that took us over 2 years.
Demand is so great. INSA doubled its cultivation capacity in August, and now it's doubling it again. The supply shortage got worse this fall after the state banned vaping cartridges, which were 20% to 30% of legal purchases. Some vaping customers shifted to the black market. Others stuck with the stores and started buying flower instead. Gallagher says the supply is also stymied by a bottleneck during required testing. There are only 2 licensed testing labs in the state. At CDX Analytics in Salem, laboratory assistant Kate Stablanko is preparing a sample for testing by grinding it using a mortar and pestle. The distinct scent of marijuana wafts into the air.
It takes some getting used to, but I worked at a brewery before this, so I'm...
We're going to interrupt that story, and if you were as riveted as I was, I apologize, but we have an opportunity to have Congressman Seth Moulton join us now on the line from his office in Salem, and there is too much to talk about to pass that up. So, Congressman Moulton, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's always good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Really appreciate you joining us. There's a lot to talk about today, Congressman, as there usually is when we have you on, including the latest impeachment proceedings. I do want to start, though, by asking you about President Trump's recent decision to pardon Navy SEAL Eddie Gallagher. Gallagher's been accused of a number of war crimes. This past summer, he was acquitted on a host of charges, including murder, but he was convicted on one charge of posing for a trophy photo with a corpse. You served four tours in Iraq and the U.S. Marines. I really want to know, what was your reaction to the president's intervention in this case?
I was absolutely furious. I think what the president has done is despicable. And it undermines the moral courage that 99.9% of Americans who put on the uniform and serve the country show every single day in very challenging circumstances in combat when we do the right thing and we're not war criminals. And to have the president of the United States, the commander in chief, celebrating a war criminal and allowing him to basically go off into the sunset as a hero when he should be going into the brig, it's absolutely despicable.
Congressman, I want to ask you this question because I don't actually know the answer to this question. The thing he was convicted of is posing for a trophy photo with a corpse. Does that qualify as a war crime under international conventions?
I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but it certainly doesn't, my understanding.
Okay.
I mean, that is something that you don't do.
And so
and
what kind
of
message does
he
this send? Sorry, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Look, this is a man who had his own fellow SEALs, the people that he was supposed to be leading and setting the example for testify against him. And, I guess he was acquitted of the murder charges and what else. Some of that was on technicalities. I think it's pretty darn serious when you have members of your own team testifying against you that you murdered civilians and did things that, that would land any other person who wasn't as politically connected as Eddie Gallagher is into prison. And when the president of the United States, who's supposed to be the commander in chief, who's supposed to set the example for everybody who serves in uniform, despite the fact that he, of course, dodged the draft to avoid serving himself, when he celebrates people like Gallagher, it undermines the good service of everybody else.
What is the message that it sends, Congressman? What message does it send to the troops when he does this?
It sends a message to the troops that our values don't matter. It sends a message to our allies that America is not always the good guy. It sends a message to our enemies that you should feel free to violate the Geneva Conventions against our troops because we violate it against yours. So there is nothing good that comes out of this. And I've heard from senior people in the military who have been avid Trump supporters who reached out to me just because of this and said, I'm done. I cannot support Donald Trump when he undermines every moral leader in the military today by pardoning this war criminal.
So just one more question on this, and there are several other things I'd love to ask you about. You talked about Eddie Gallagher's political connections, and the president is using Eddie Gallagher on the campaign trail and getting very strong positive response from people who attend President Trump's campaign rallies. What do you make of that? And what do you think Gallagher stands for the people who are cheering the president in this step and at those rallies?
Well, sadly, the president is tapping into the worst angels of people's nature, to borrow a phrase from Abraham Lincoln, who talked about how it's up to leaders, specifically presidents, to find the better angels in American nature. And so when Trump celebrates these things, he's tapping into the anger and resentment that a lot of Americans have. And now some people have anger and resentment for legitimate reasons. But to turn that anger, resentment into support for war criminals, into support for, the quote unquote good people on both sides that the president, which is how the president described, the neo-Nazis rallying in Charlottesville. To support people who make racist insults against colleagues of mine in Congress, that's really bringing out the worst of America. And that's not what we need from the leadership that we have in the Oval Office.
And what would you like people here in the United States and around the world to be thinking about and understand about the American military in this moment?
You know, when I served in the Marines, our division motto, when I was actually serving under then General Jim Mattis, who, of course, became Secretary Jim Mattis, Trump's own Secretary of Defense, before resigning because he disagreed with the president. Our motto was, no better friend, no worse enemy, the United States Marine. That means that our allies trust us and our enemies trust our resolve. If you want to work with us, we will respect you. We will work. We'll be the best friends you've ever had. If you want to fight us, then you're in for a hard time, because you won't find a worse enemy. And that should be the motto for the United States of America. You know, when we go to battle, we go because we have morality on our side, because we are carrying American values with us in everything that we do. That should be the message. That's the most powerful weapon that we ever took into conflict. And the president, someone who was happy to have other people go and called to serve in Vietnam, obviously doesn't understand this.
Congressman, I'm going to shift gears here. You represent the Commonwealth in the U.S. House of Representatives, and, you know, most people are aware that there are impeachment hearings going on, and there are more scheduled for later this week. We're going to see the first public hearing held by the Judiciary Committee. The Intelligence Committee is releasing its report privately later today to the full committee. What do you think the Democrats need to and want to accomplish this week?
Well, we just need to continue exposing the facts to the American people, because the facts are damning. And I didn't get elected to go to Congress to impeach a president. You know, this isn't about politics. This is about upholding our Constitution and fundamentally upholding that basic American principle that nobody is above the law. And if the president of the United States violates the law, then it's our duty to hold impeachment hearings. And what every one of the hearings has shown to date is that the facts against this president are damning. The fact that he would withhold an arms deal from a critical ally that's fighting Russia every single day just to support his own political interests, to rig the 2020 election in his favor. I mean, this goes to the heart of what the founders, the framers of our Constitution called foreign interference in elections. And the fact that it's actually being done by an American, who's the commander-in-chief himself, if that's not high crimes and misdemeanors, which is what the Constitution defines as an impeachable offense, I don't know what is. This is so much worse than the burglary supported by Richard Nixon.
Congressman, the president has headed to London for a NATO summit, and both he and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo have attacked the Democrats for scheduling a hearing on Wednesday while President Trump is at this NATO summit. I am curious, what do you think of that criticism, and why not wait till he's back in the country? Why do this while the president is representing us at NATO?
Well, the president has never supported NATO in his entire career, so I guess we probably figured that it would be a convenient time to do it. I mean, in all seriousness, the fact that the first time the president has ever done anything good for NATO is when it's convenient for him to avoid appearing before Congress is something that I don't think will be lost on many people. The president's trying to come up with every excuse he can to complain about the process by which we're holding impeachment hearings. And that's because his behavior, that's because the basic facts of the case are totally indefensible. And it applies not just to the president and the secretary of state who came up with this convenient excuse to complain about the process. It applies to all the Republicans who are constantly complaining about the process, even attacking some of the people, the brave patriots like Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, who have come forward at great personal political risk to share the facts with the American people. They're attacking all these people. They're attacking the process because they cannot defend what the president did.
So I really want to switch in our last minute, Congressman, to a more local issue, because you have put out an op-ed in support of supervised consumption sites, which is something we've talked about a lot here on Radio Boston. I do want to ask you, why is that something that you support here in Massachusetts?
You know, the opioid crisis, the addiction crisis affects every community in our state, rich and poor, black and white. Every family is touched by this in some way. There are enough people who have died from the opioid crisis in Massachusetts to fill TD Garden for a Bruins game. And if it if that many people were dying from any other crisis, we would realize it's an emergency and we've got to do whatever we can to help right away. The only reason why these...
So I think we make...
It's hard to talk about, but they save lives. The bottom line is these sites save lives. And when you have that many people in Massachusetts dying, whatever we can to save lives.
That is Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton. We've just lost him on the line, but I do appreciate Congressman Moulton being with us here on Radio Boston today. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Jamie Bologna, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Koeg is our technical director, and we had engineering help today from Max Liebman. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tisiana Deering. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.